My bad.
That's not with a B.
That's not with a B. No, I remember.
Okay, thanks for inviting me. So the main subject of the talk is going to be the deconfinement transition in strongly coupled gauge theories. And a certain sort of method for studying that transition. But to give some idea of where we're going, let me start with a much simpler system, which is sort of the probably one of the first places where undergraduate students really understand phase transitions, which is the ferromagnet. Okay, so the best way to understand the thermodynamics of the ferromagnet is to draw a free energy diagram. So the macroscopic observable, the order parameter for the phase transitions that you study, there is the magnetization, okay, or the average magnetization over some sample. And then you draw the free energy as a function of that magnetization. And at low temperatures, you know, it looks something like this. It's usually some quartic function, I guess. And you know, then at high temperatures, you develop a local maximum. And you can immediately read off from how the free energy diagram changes as a function of temperature all of the interesting thermodynamic behavior of the system, the phase transitions, first order, second order, critical, the spontaneous symmetry breaking, and what the phase diagram looks like. Because if you do a phase diagram of temperature versus external magnetic field, which is a chemical potential for the magnetization, then you see what that chemical potential does is simply tilts the free energy diagram one way or the other. And then you can see, you know, the first order transition you get above the critical temperature, and so on. So everything is sort of encoded and is, you know, made nicely visually clear by drawing these free energy diagrams. Now, what are you actually doing when you're what is these diagrams actually plotting? Well, basically, you're doing an extreme form of Wilsonian renormalization, where you're integrating out not just normally in effective field theory, you integrate out everything but a finite number of fields. Here you integrate out everything but a finite number, in this case, a single mode of a field. Okay, so you get the whole thing down to one degree of freedom, which should be, in some sense, the lightest degree of freedom for this to be a well-defined procedure. Okay, so you're saying, even though maybe this value of the magnetization is not the actual value that the system ever takes, maybe it's a value that it never takes in any phase, nonetheless, you're saying, well, what happens if I fix the magnetization to this value and I integrate out all the other degrees of freedom, then what is the effective free energy? Okay, so sort of formally, you're rewriting your partition function . You're sort of expanding it out. So let's say this is where this thing is simply the whole thing, but with a delta function put in to the path, inserted into the path integral. It's basically the expectation value of this delta function operator. Okay. And so what we want to do is basically the same thing, but in a system where the best way to understand the system, because we're going to be talking about a strongly coupled gauge theory, which we understand holographically, is as a gravitational system. And so the question is, how do you do this procedure in a gravitational system? Okay, and the basic idea for everything I'm going to say was explained in a paper that I wrote with Toby Wiseman last year. So let's actually jump into the system we're talking about. No surprise here. Let's see if I know how to use my clicker. So we're going to do n equals 4 super Yang mils. At finite temperature, we're going to compactify it on S3. And so this is the Euclidean space where the field theory lives, unit S3, circumference of the S1, 1 over T. And everything in the talk is going to be working in the TUF limit. Okay. Now, interestingly, this the fact that it's compactified on S3 means you get certain new effects. For example, even in the free limit, when the TUF coupling is zero, you still have a confinement-deconfinement transition, which is a first-order transition at a certain temperature. Can you guys see this? Do I have to tell you what it says? Okay, I'll just tell you what it says. So if you look at the free energy as a function of temperature, I guess that helps a little bit, below this TH, which is called TH because it's some form of a Hagedorn transition, the free energy is of order 1, meaning that the degrees of freedom are essentially colorless glue balls, whereas above this transition, the free energy becomes of order n squared. So order 1 means order 1 in n. Above this, it becomes order n squared, meaning that there are the colored elementary fields are liberated. Okay, so that's one order parameter you have for the phase transition. And another one you have is the Polyakov loop, which is the Wilson line around the time direction. And for convenience, what these people studied was not the Wilson line. Normally, the Wilson line would be sort of going around the S1 at some fixed point on the S3. But they averaged the gauge field, working in some fixed gauge, they averaged the gauge field over the S3. Okay, because they wanted the lightest degree of freedom. It doesn't matter for what I'm saying on this slide, but it'll matter for the next slide. Okay, so you have this unitary matrix, path-ordered exponential of this, and then you're looking at the average eigenvalue of that. And this object, this unitary matrix, is charged under the Zn center of the gauge group. And it vanishes, or its average eigenvalue vanishes below the phase transition, whereas it doesn't vanish above the phase transition. Okay, which means that we have breaking of this Zn center. And so these are the results of their analysis. Now, how did they calculate this? And again, I mean, the way to do it is to go to a free energy diagram for this order parameter, W. Okay. And this is why we do the average over the S3. So you ask, what is the free energy as a function of W? W goes from 0 to 1 because it's the average eigenvalue of a unitary matrix. And I mean, it could be complex. W lives in the unit disk, but so this is really absolute value W. And when you do that, which in the free case is not too hard to do, you see that above this Hagedorn temperature, you're stuck at W equals 0. And then below it, this basically you get a negative quadratic. I mean, there's quite an interesting story, which I'm not going through in detail here. But this part of the curve is quadratic up to 1/2. At 1/2, you have this Gross-Witten transition where the distribution of eigenvalues on the unit circle develops a gap. And it becomes much more complicated between 1/2 and 1. But anyway, once you know that even just the quadratic part, you know that there's already a phase transition when the coefficient of that quadratic part becomes negative. And because what I've plotted is f over n squared, you see that f is going like n squared in this phase. And there's been a lot of subsequent work on this system, which is, I see conveniently the names of all of the people are very hard to read. Sorry about that. But you know, most of this work has essentially been using this notion of an effective potential or off-shell free energy for the Polyakov loop to study various aspects of the system. Okay. And that's kind of how this business started. And now the question is, what happens at strong coupling? Well, so before talking about the Polyakov loop, at strong coupling, you work holographically with supergravity on an asymptotically ADS space. So I'm going to basically, for the moment, I'm going to forget about the S5. As everyone here no doubt knows, there's, because of the boundary conditions, there's a Hawking Page, first order Hawking Page transition, below which the dominant thermal state is thermal ADS, and so the free energy is of order one, which comes from the gravitons. There's a gas of graviton sitting in the bottom of the potential well of ADS. And above the Hawking Page temperature, the dominant state is a large black hole, and the free energy is of order n squared, just because from a gravitational point of view, that comes about because you have the gravitational action is 1 over g Newton times some stuff. So if this stuff is of order 1, and g Newton is basically 1 over n squared, then the free energy is of order n squared. And so this is clearly an analog of what I was talking about before, but I've only given you one of the two order parameters, namely the free energy. So how do you compute the Polyakov loop in this setting? Well, it's hard to compute the Polyakov loop per se, but there's a version of it which is not a unitary matrix, but which is charged under the Z. You want some order parameter which is charged under the Zn. You want to know whether the Zn is broken or not. Okay. And so there's a locally half BPS version of the Polyakov loop, which includes a coupling to the scalar. So these capital phi I are the scalars of my theory. This is the so-called Wilson-Maldacena loop, which is now the Polyakov-Maldacena loop because we're taking it still around the S1, the thermal S1. Theta is a unit vector in R6. And how do you compute this? Well, that depends whether this S1, when you look at the Euclidean geometry in the bulk, whether the S1 on the boundary is contractible or not. If it is contractible, then you get a finite result for this W prime, implying that the center symmetry is broken. If it's not contractible, then you get zero. So let's do those two cases. This is below the Hawking Page transition. Oops. So here's thermal ADS. So the Euclidean manifold, in the Euclidean manifold, the S3 is contractible. And so you get zero for the Polyakov-Maldacena loop, whereas above the Hawking Page transition, you get one of these black hole cigar geometries. And it turns out that log of W prime, because W prime is e to the minus the world sheet action over alpha prime, well, the world sheet action, the scale of the world sheet area here is set by the ADS radius. And so the ADS radius squared divided by alpha prime is lambda to the 1/2. So actually, this W prime, which is the average eigenvalue of path-ordered exponential going around the S1, is very large. So before, that thing was a unitary matrix when we were talking about the Polyakov loop. Now it's not a unitary matrix anymore because it's not the exponential of I times a Hermitian matrix. Okay, so therefore, the eigenvalue distribution in principle is over the whole plane, and the average eigenvalue need not lie on inside the unit disk. And in fact, it turns out that it's extremely large. So we're working at large lambda, of course. And so it turns out that it's extremely large. It's nowhere near the unit circle. So the center symmetry is broken. Now, so what does all of this mean? Sort of more, this looks a bit formal. So physically, in the Lorentzian picture, I see. That says this is also a deconfinement transition. And it's a deconfinement transition for the reasons I gave, but you can just see it more physically by looking at a constant time slice. And the point is simply that your Polyakov loop is inserting a single quark. You're asking whether you're allowed to insert a single quark or not. And in a confining phase, you're not. And in the string theory, that's because this single quark source is a string which goes out into the bulk and is very sad because it has nowhere to end. And that's just not allowed. Okay, but if there's a black hole, it can end on the horizon. And the horizon, this says horizon screens quark charge. Okay, so from the boundary point of view, this quark is surrounded by a field, but that field is decaying exponentially because of in the holographic picture because of the presence of the horizon. Okay, so it's all sort of nice picture. And again, this has been studied. So this basic picture was already explained in 98 by Witten, but there's been a revival of interest for several reasons, one of them being this work by Aharoni et al. On the weak coupling side, which discovered this deconfinement transition. And again, the issue has been the effective potential for either the Polyakov loop W or this Polyakov Maldacena loop W prime. And there have been basically two approaches. One is to say, well, W is nicer because it's a unitary matrix. And so we can write down some phenomenological matrix models for W and study the free energy diagram we get from that. So there'll be some unknown coefficients in that model, but you appeal to universality. And the other approach has been to say, has been less quantitative in this sense, to say, well, if you already know the saddle points, which you do in this case. I mean, you know not just the thermodynamically dominant ones, but you know that, for example, there's also this small black hole, and there's also presumably a 10-dimensional black hole at sufficiently high temperature. So you know various bits and pieces, and then you can just sort of sketch out the, to fill out what the rest of the free energy diagram probably looks like. And that's sort of where I came into this, because I've been to several talks where people have done this sort of thing, and then you'll typically get a question from the audience like, well, so if you wanted to actually compute that quantitatively, like what is this thing that you're drawing, and if you wanted to compute it quantitatively, even in principle, what would the computation be? You know, what does it mean to say I'm fixing the value of the Polyakov loop or the Polyakov Maldacena loop in this gravitational system? How do I do that? What I want to show is that you can do it. It's very sensible. And the basic technique is something that goes back, as far as I know, to work by York in the 80s. So that's going to be the purpose of the rest of the talk. Okay, so now I need to be slightly more precise. I need to fix my order parameter. It's going to be basically the order parameter that Aharoni et al. Used, but with the averaging over the S3 done in a different order. So this log of W prime is basically, or the temperature times the log of W prime is the is basically the free energy cost to add a quark to the system. This is not a quantum expectation value. This is an average over the S3 and the S5. So this W prime depended on what point on the S3 you insert the quark, and then you also had to pick a point, a unit vector in R6. And so we want the lightest mode in the same sense that this M here is not the magnetization at some point in the sample, it's the average magnetization over the sample, that's the lightest mode, so we want the same thing, okay? Another thing to say is that since we're in the large N limit, these observables are classical observables, so we don't need to really talk about expectation values per se, okay? But then we saw before that this thing, when it's non-zero, it scales like lambda to the 1/2. So we just want to get something finite, we divide by lambda to the 1/2. Okay, and so in the bulk, that is simply the average area of a world sheet, which is wrapping the S1 averaged over the S3 and the S5. Okay? And from now on, we'll just set the ADS radius to 1. Okay, and again, this is what we want to calculate. We want to insert into the path integral this delta function. Okay, so this little phis are all of our supergravity fields. And as usual, since we're at large n, we're going to work in the saddle point approximation. Okay, so how do you do it? How do you fix it? You fix it by adding a Lagrange multiplier to the action. So kappa is our Lagrange multiplier. For convenience, I've divided by t. And you find the new solutions, the new saddle points, and you compute the action at the new solution. And that gives you f as a function of kappa or as a function of capital phi. Those are conjugate variables, so those two functions are related by a Legendre transform. And in fact, in practice, what you really do is once you get the relation, the on-shell relation between kappa and phi, then you use the fact that they're conjugate variables to extract f. When I say on-shell, I mean on-shell with respect to this new action. Okay. These otherwise, in the sort of, if you step back and forget about the formal procedure we're following, these are off-shell configurations. They don't satisfy the actual equations of motion of the system. Okay.
So little phi represents the supergravity fields.
Right.
And big phi is some functional of those describing a string, the area of a string world, the minimal area of a string world sheet with particular boundary conditions.
Right, exactly.
Right. The subject to varying all the supergravity.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so what does it do when I add this Lagrange multiplier? Well, it changes the equations of motion, of course. And it effectively adds a stress tensor which corresponds to a static string whose tension is kappa, which runs out from the horizon to the boundary and is smeared over the S3 and the S5. So let me draw a picture. So in the Euclidean picture, we have our... So I should say that as soon as you set phi, as soon as you're interested in situations in which capital phi is non-zero, you are talking about, topologically, a configuration with a horizon. Okay, so necessarily a situation where the S1 is contractible in the bulk. And then you're fixing the area of this thing, of this cigar. And so you've added what amounts to a cosmological constant in the r tau direction, okay, and nothing to the stress tensor in the angular direction. There's this S3 and S5 sitting on top of this, okay. But this string is smeared over the S3 and the S5, okay. Yeah. Wait one slide and then, yeah. So, I mean, I have that, right. What I've been saying so far is somewhat vague. That's true. But if you, I'll answer it now. Basically, what I've been saying so far is assuming that the solution preserves the SO4 symmetry and the SO2 symmetry and the SO6 symmetry of the boundary conditions. So the problem, because the quark I put in, which I've smeared over my S3 and my S5, and which is static, The problem has an SO2 times SO4 times SO6 symmetry. If you assume that the solution shares that symmetry, so the problem is well defined as a problem in gravity, whether or not the solution actually has that symmetry. But it's easier to think about it, it's easier to draw it if it does. Okay, I mean, the problem is well posed as a problem in general relativity, whether or not the solution has that symmetry. But if it does have that symmetry, then what you have is an object called a hedgehog black hole, which is a black hole that has a string coming out of it in all directions. Okay. Let's do a warm up problem where we forget about supergravity, and we forget about the S5, and we do pure gravity with a negative cosmological constant in five dimensions. Okay, and it's very pretty actually the way it works out. It's surprisingly pretty, and the corresponding problem in four dimensions was solved. It's so, you know, what you get is so pretty that I suspect it's actually been done by many people, but it's in the literature, as far as I know, by Gwendolman and Rabinowitz. And actually, I think it makes a very nice exercise, you know, if you're teaching general relativity, to go through this kind of thing. I mean, forgetting about the whole thermodynamic interpretation, just the question, if I have a black hole with this particular kind of matter, namely a string running off to infinity, smeared over the angular directions, what is the solution? Okay, so this is the change. So again, we assume that this SO2 times SO4 is not spontaneously broken. This is the change in the action. And so the Einstein equation, so this is the cosmological term that we had before, and then in the RR and tau tau directions, you pick up this extra term. And it's divided by the proper volume of the S3, just because that string is sort of getting diluted. If the S3 is large, then of course the string is getting diluted in the angular directions. Okay? Now it turns out that as long as you have this condition, GRR equals G tau tau, and nothing for GR tau, then it follows, and there's a paper on this recently by Ted Jacobson, it follows that that the solution can be written in its usual Schwarzschild form, F of R D tau squared plus F of R inverse DR squared, which is nice. So it all comes down to what is this function F of R? And what's even nicer is that if you want to figure out what F of R is, you can do it and get the right answer by using purely Newtonian reasoning. Okay, so people, if I write here, can people see? Maybe not. I'll do it over here. So F of R in Newtonian reasoning is 1 minus the gravitational potential at the radius R. We're assuming spherical symmetry, okay? What is V of R? V of R is the total mass inside a sphere of radius R divided by R squared. It would be divided by R in four dimensions, but we're in five dimensions, so it's divided by R squared. Now, there are several contributions to M of R. So here's flat space. Okay, so nothing. Now ADS is, you add an R squared, and this is the vacuum energy, okay, which is negative and which goes like R to the fourth, because we have a sphere of radius R in four spatial dimensions. Okay, here's ADS Schwarzschild, where you just have some constant amount of mass sitting at the center. I mean, it's basically an integration constant, okay? So what are you going to do if you have a string running out that has sort of constant mass per unit length? Well, it's the mass within a sphere of radius R is just going to be proportional to R. So you're just going to get kappa over R. And this is an exact solution to these Einstein equations. The different contributions just add up. They just add up. They don't interact with each other. So now we have our boundary conditions. So tau is periodic with period 1 over t. Mu, as usual, is fixed by the condition of smoothness at the horizon. And that gives you this relation between kappa. I mean, it's just you do one line of algebra, and you get this relation between kappa and the horizon radius. So you just eliminate mu. And that's, so for a given temperature and a given kappa, you just have to solve this equation to find out what RH is. And then that gives you your solution, okay? Now, and then you can, then once you have your solution, you compute its Euclidean action, okay, which you can do. It's a mess. And of course, it's a mess because you have to renormalize, and so it's quite complicated. But it comes out finite if you do it.
Can you always get just one solution, one real solution in the right wide range of the cubic equation, or can there be more than one?
There can be more than one, yeah. There can definitely be more than one. But what we're going to do, what we're going to see is that actually you should use RH as your parameter. And the reason is what we really want is the relation between phi, our order parameter, and kappa. Okay, so what is phi? For a given solution, what is phi? Okay, it's very easy to compute. Oops. Okay, so I'll have to tell you what those things are. Okay, phi is minus the temperature times the area of the R tau disk. Okay, now the metric in the R tau directions, because we had f of r d tau squared plus f of r inverse dr squared, the f's cancel. And so it's just the integral of dr, and then, okay, so you throw away an infinite thing. You have to renormalize this, just like you have to renormalize the action. You throw away an infinity, and you get that phi is equal to rh. So actually, so this is our relation between kappa and phi, and then you integrate that to get the relation between, to get f as a function of phi. Okay, so this is the free energy diagram we've been after. These are various temperatures. And they are basically, what this says is 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, where those are the values of 2 pi t squared. Okay, and I chose those because you can see, for example, when 2 pi t squared is 8, that's this curve, that's the critical temperature where the two... So below this critical temperature, there's no other saddle points besides thermal ADS. Thermal ADS is sitting here. Boy, my pointer is running out of juice. Is there a... Use this. Oh, huge stick. Great. Perfect. Okay, and then above the critical temperature... you have two new solutions, the small black hole and the large black hole. And this curve is at the Hawking-Page temperature. And so if you go even above this temperature, then it becomes the thermodynamically dominant saddle point over this thermal ADS. The small black hole, you see that it's thermodynamically unstable. It's never a dominant saddle point in any phase. So all of the features of the thermodynamics of this system become manifest. In these free energy diagrams. And what you can do with this, one thing you can do with it is you can ask, what happens if I add a chemical potential for phi to the system? And you can just read it off from these free energy diagrams. So what we do, this says f goes to f plus kappa phi. So we're just adding kappa phi. So now kappa is not a Lagrange multiplier, it's a chemical potential. Okay. Let's do for a second the case where kappa is zero. So that's here. And then here's the Hawking-Page transition. Below it you have thermal ADS, above it you have a large black hole. Now what happens if we're below, just a little bit below the Hawking-Page temperature? And so we're somewhere between these two curves, okay? Or even, we can even look at this curve. Let's look at this curve. And we add a small kappa. Okay, so before we were sitting here, which is thermal ADS, now what kappa does is it tilts the curve down, and so you end up with a curve which has a new minimum, which is here, and then it goes back up, okay? And so that thing is what I call the tiny black hole. And what it is, it's not the small black hole. The small black hole is this unstable thing, okay? It's smaller than the small black hole, and it's something that's supported only by the tension of this string. The horizon is supported from collapse only by the tension of this string. And it's stable, okay? And it's the dominant, it's not just locally stable, but it's the global minimum. And then if I keep tilting, so again, look at this curve here. If I keep tilting, eventually this one, because there's a hump here, it'll drop below zero, and then it'll drop below the minimum we had before. So let me just draw that. So it'll at first it'll look like this, and then if I keep turning on kappa, it'll look like this, and eventually it'll be dominant. And this is just basically the large black hole that we had before. I mean, it's slightly altered by the fact that there's this kappa, which is sort of changing its, quantitatively changing the horizon size, but it's essentially the large black hole. Okay, so that's a first order transition because you have a jump between these two states. So that's this first order transition. But if you keep lowering the temperature, then that first order transition disappears because this hump that separates the tiny black hole from the large black hole at low temperatures disappears. Because it's just a quartic function. I mean, you can see it from this. If T is small enough, then this thing will, then there'll never be a place where the second derivative is negative as a function of phi. Okay, and so this first order phase transition ends at a critical point. I don't know the deep meaning of this, whether there's some interesting physics happening at this critical point. It's not obvious either way. Okay, so this is, I find this quite pretty. It sort of illuminates the Hawking page transition, makes it into this nice visual thing. But what we weren't interested in was pure gravity. We were interested in supergravity on ADS5 times S5. And what we're going to do is, we're going to assume for the moment that the solution, as I said before, preserves the full isometry group of the boundary conditions. And if you do that, then you're reduced to a problem in one dimension, which is, of course, why we did that. And then the only active fields become, there are four of them, the dilaton and the sizes of the three different spheres. And you get some complicated equations of motion. So it's an ordinary differential equation, which is a bit of a mess, or it's four coupled ordinary differential equations. And it's just sort of on the boundary where Mathematica can handle it. Okay, Mathematica can handle it with a lot of hand-holding, basically. But you slave away at it for a month and a half, and finally you get answers you can trust. So this is kappa over n squared, and so before we get to the free energy diagram, what you see is that the relation between kappa and phi is quite different from what we had before, because what we had before, the curves, which were cubic curves, went through the origin, and here they don't go to the origin. They go along and then they just turn around and head back up. Which means that, I mean, the purpose of the exercise was to fix phi at different values and see what is the free energy at different fixed values of phi. And so in some sense, we failed because, you know, at a given temperature, there's just some minimum value of phi below which you cannot find solutions. Well, okay, but let's proceed anyway and draw the free energy diagram based on integrating this. And again, I mean, it has all of the features that we had before. So anytime you get a local minimum or maximum, that's a conventional black hole. So that's a situation where kappa is zero, where this diagram where it's crossing the axis. Okay, so again, we have the critical temperature, we have the small black hole, large black hole, Hawking page transition. Okay. Now, but the thing is, so this puzzled me for a while, but you have to remember that we made an assumption about the symmetries, and basically what's happening is that the assumption is breaking down. I don't think we have to worry about spontaneous breaking of the SO2 or SO4, but we know we have to worry about spontaneous breaking of the SO6. We know that because if you look, for example, at the small black hole at sufficiently high temperature, for example, at the Hawking page temperature, that is already dynamically unstable. There's a Gregory-Laflamme instability, which is basically due to the fact that the S5 is over which the horizon is smeared is much larger than the horizon size itself. And in any situation like that, you're going to develop a Gregory-Laflamme instability. So in fact, there is some other direction here which represents breaking of the SO6 where you get an instability. On the other hand, we know that the large black hole is stable because it has a horizon radius which is much larger than the S5. And so so somehow what the real free energy diagram should look like is that somewhere between the large and the small black holes, you develop an instability, and the actual minimum of the free energy at a fixed phi is lower than that, than the one that you get by looking only at SO6 preserving solutions. So what I've drawn here is just the simplest scenario. So basically we're back in the territory of sketching out, making a sketch of the free energy diagram based on what you know about the saddle points. Okay, and the reason is that the actual problem, I mean, it's perfectly well posed, but it's just more difficult because now it depends on finding the solutions, depends on at least two variables instead of one, so it becomes a harder problem. So this green line is not any computation, okay? It's just, I just took a drawing program and drew in a green line, okay?
For the very small, for the black holes where phi is almost zero, can you argue that those solutions obviously exist? I mean, do you know what the metric roughly looks like?
Well, I think it should, you know, if we could have done the exercise that I did in five-dimensional pure gravity and 10-dimensional pure gravity. I mean, it's completely, it works out exactly the same way. And so for those where it's very small, I think it's likely that in the neighborhood of the black hole, it looks like a 10-dimensional hedgehog black hole. Then, of course, you have to patch that on to ADS5 times S5. So it's the same problem you usually have finding the small, the 10-dimensional black hole. And that's why, that's in fact why I feel justified in continuing this green line all the way down to the origin. Because I think that down here, those solutions probably look like that. And so they probably exist, yeah.
That's why the Nevers-Schwarz 3 falls, isn't it?
Oh, okay. That has to do with what we do is to be very careful. If you're working at finite n, you cannot. So this whole story I told you about how you can put in a single quark if you're in a deconfined phase. Of course, that's not true at finite n. You have to put in a quark antiquark, and so really the order parameter really that I use is to put in a quark and an antiquark on antipodal points on the S3. Okay, and then the total contribution to the B field from that, and then I smear that over the S3, and the total sourcing of the B field vanishes when you do that. So, but you're right that to be careful, yeah. And I mean, what that B field, so when you read Witten's paper, in fact, he doesn't say anything about the deconfinement transition because his argument is, in fact, that there is no such transition. And the reason is that this Polyakov loop always vanishes. And the reason it always vanishes is because, in the bulk, is because of this B field. Okay, so, but if you go to infinite n and do things carefully and use, for example, for an order parameter, a quark anti-quark pair, then it's fine. Okay, so, yeah.
So is this breaking of S06 to S05? I mean, is it localization on S5?
It's presumably localization on S5 to a 10-dimensional black hole. I don't think it's known for sure whether there aren't other weird black hole, black ring configurations that break it down more, some more complicated symmetry breaking pattern. But it is, I would say, pretty much known, or there are very, very strong arguments that there exists a 10-dimensional black hole which is localized on the S5, breaks it down to SO5.
And some people have seen these things when you include the scalars also.
At weak coupling, they've looked for, so this Hollowood, Kumar, and Nakvi, have looked for this spontaneous SO6 breaking at weak coupling.
And they found some saddle points.
And they found some, and they found some saddle points. So
it's not clear that's associated with black holes. There are some, I mean, it's kind of, it looks like that isn't, they aren't obviously black holes, that's some symmetry breaking.
Okay.
Six, but it's not.
Oh,
it's
I see.
Related, you said,
it's not.
What's the likely problem?
Well, they're looking at, as I remember, they're looking at these, saddle points of the free energy, but rather special configurations of eigenvalues of the, they dimensionally reduce basically on the sphere.
Mm-hmm.
They get some matrix model. But they look at very specific eigenvalue distributions that look very different to the ones I think naively you would expect a black hole to look like. They're very
presumably
spread
those
out
right.
Eigenvalues, for example.
The actual distribution could change a lot as you vary the top.
I mean, they could be continuously connected to 10-dimensional black holes, right? Is that ruled out? Or?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm not sure.
I mean, it's hard to make the extrapolation from weak to strong coupling, so, So as I said, we're back in the land of making sketches based on known properties of the saddle points. Although, as a matter of principle, I think, we've said how you do the computation if you actually wanted to know what, this is right. But assuming that this is that this is right, then you can sketch the corresponding phase diagram where again this is kappa. Again, at kappa equals zero, you have the same Hawking page transition you had before, but now what happens when you turn on a small value of kappa below the Hawking page transition is you don't get the same kind of tiny black hole, you get a 10-dimensional black hole. And that actually has a different symmetry from the 5-dimensional black hole. So the first order transition separating the 10-dimensional tiny black hole from the large 5-dimensional black hole can't end anywhere. Okay, they have different symmetries. So this, I don't know what happens to it. I don't know if it ends at zero temperature, or if it goes off to infinity, or what. When you think about it, you see that it has to start with a negative slope, but that's about the only thing I can say about it. So anyway, this is sort of for future work, and I'll leave it at that. Thanks. No, I don't think from the gravity point of view.
I mean, from just the field theory.
You know, it can happen that when you try to do a saddle point analysis, you can have a perfectly well-defined path integral which has no saddle points. So in principle, the path, it has some value, but when you try to do a saddle point analysis, it fails, and then it becomes this, and that's basically what would be happening if there, you know, I'm not saying that this quantity doesn't exist. I'm just saying you can't get it by a saddle point approximation. Those are very difficult. I mean, I'm not exactly sure how you're supposed to deal with those kinds of situations.
But I mean, is it, from the point of view of field theory, is it completely obvious that there should be, you should be able to get expectation values of the Polyakov loop between zero and whatever?
In the sense that, I mean, if you believe, you know, maybe this is too formal, and maybe there's some subtlety which I'm missing, but at least formally I can ask, what is the expectation value of this operator? Okay, make M my phi. I don't know. I mean, it is a bit formal, so.
Okay, all right, let's thank Matt again.